It's the leading cause of death in the United States, killing nearly 130,000 Americans each year. That's one in every 19 deaths. And now, there's a new recommendation from the American Academy of Neurology regarding prevention. And here with me to tell us more about it is the lead author of that updated guideline, Dr. Antonio Calabres. He's professor of neurology at Upstate Medical University and a fellow of the American Academy of Neurology. Welcome, Dr. Calabres. Thanks
for coming. Pleasure to be here.
So you've just published a new guideline for stroke prevention. I think it was in the February issue of the medical journal called Neurology. Can you tell us about it?
That is correct. This is an updated guideline on the prevention of cardioembolic stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. Since the last publication by the American Academy of Neurology in 1998 on the same topic, there have been many new and very exciting developments. Among other things, there are three new agents, oral anticoagulants for the prevention of stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation, that are very effective and very safe. The guideline addresses these new medications.
So let me stop you there and ask you, exactly what is the new guideline, if you can state it in a sentence?
The new guideline has two main chapters. The first chapter is identification of atrial fibrillation in patients with what we call cryptogenic stroke. A cryptogenic stroke is a stroke without a known cause. In many such instances, by the way, this is 25% of the strokes coming to the hospital, in many such instances, we strongly suspect that atrial fibrillation is the culprit. And that is because atrial fibrillation can come and go, paroxysmal, intermittent atrial fibrillation. And it may be difficult to identify while the patient is in the hospital. So the guideline addresses this problem by recommending the use of devices that are worn by the patient for a period of time, could be a few days, could be a few weeks, even a few months. And this is a new way of identifying atrial fibrillation. Chapter 2 of the guidelines addresses the question of what medications to administer and how we select what medications for what patient. Clearly, each patient has a different profile, and physicians need to have a judgment, clinical judgment, about what to administer. And the guidelines have the objective of reducing that uncertainty.
Help us understand, though, what atrial fibrillation is. I mean, it's obviously intermittent. So it comes and goes for people. Who is likely to have it, for example, and what exactly is it?
Atrial fibrillation is an irregular beat of the heart. It's an irregular rhythm. And because the rhythm is irregular, the heart can go very fast. Sometimes it goes very slow and causes symptoms such as dizziness and lightheadedness. There are times when this irregular heartbeat does not cause any symptoms. This irregular heartbeat can be intermittent, comes and goes, or can be chronic. If it's chronic and there all the time, it's easy to identify with an electrocardiogram. However, if it happens only intermittently, it may be more difficult to identify.
Hence, you want people to wear devices to try to track their, basically, their heart functioning over time. What exactly is the relationship, though, to that irregular heartbeat? How does that lead to stroke?
Because the heart doesn't beat regularly, there is a change in the circulation of blood within the heart. The blood may sit in corners of the heart for long periods of time, and that facilitates the formation of clots. These clots may migrate to the brain and plug the arteries in the brain and cause strokes.
So there is that direct relationship to an irregular heartbeat, literally causing a clot to the brain.
Yes. In fact, patients with atrial fibrillation have a high risk of having strokes, particularly if they have other risk factors, such as high blood pressure or diabetes. And if they have a history of previous strokes or TIAs, then the risk of stroke is 1 in 20.
Wow. Why did this guideline change now, though? I mean, what is different about now? You alluded to the fact that there are new medications, but is there something else going on, both in this country and worldwide, that has led us to look more aggressively or to look more aggressively and treat more aggressively atrial fibrillation?
Well, atrial fibrillation comes with age. And it's precisely people who are old or very old who have the higher incidence and prevalence of atrial fibrillation. In the past, it was a relative contraindication to give powerful oral anticoagulants to people who were old because of the fear of bleeding. Now we have studied that very closely and have determined that even though there is a higher risk of bleeding in old and very old people, the risk of having a stroke is even higher. And therefore, putting things on the balance, it is clear that it's in the best benefit of patients who are old and very old who have atrial fibrillation to consider very carefully and very strongly taking oral anticoagulants.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's Health Think on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neurologist Dr. Antonio Calabres, and we're talking about a new guideline for treatment to prevent strokes. Well, let me get back to that whole idea about the age factor. Isn't it true, though, that there has been almost an epidemic increase in the amount of atrial fibrillation worldwide that we're finding? Isn't that part of what's motivated this change?
Definitely. WHO has determined that 0.5% of the general population, that is 1 in 20 persons, has atrial fibrillation around the world. So clearly this is epidemic, and it's epidemic because the population is getting progressively older, and as we said before, older people have higher chances of developing atrial fibrillation.
But getting back to this notion of who gets treated, obviously what you're saying now is that more people are being encouraged to be treated, to first find the notion of diagnosing the atrial fibrillation more aggressively and then treating. What was the major limitation before in terms of age? Was there the fear of the anticoagulants, which is the main treatment for it? And let's explain that. What does the anticoagulant do?
The anticoagulants delay the clotting of the blood. And because of that, there is always a higher chance of bleeding from a little wound or from a little vessel that could be in the skin or could be in the brain. Obviously, in the skin is of no consequence, but if this happens in the brain, it could be of major consequences. So oral anticoagulants can cause hemorrhages and can cause brain hemorrhages, which is probably the worst type of bleeding that can happen. But the new oral anticoagulants have a better profile in terms of bleeding in the brain than the other more conventional anticoagulant, which is Coumadin or warfarin. So in that respect, the new oral anticoagulants are a little safer.
And I guess this whole notion of treating older people was the fear of their falling, perhaps, and thereby incurring some kind of damage to themselves, encouraging more spontaneous bleeding.
In the past, people who fell were considered to be high risk, and therefore anticoagulations were denied. But as the anticoagulations were denied, then the risk of stroke became very high. Now we know that a few falls per month or per year do not preclude the indication of taking anticoagulants. In fact, my recommendation is that if someone falls and someone needs anticoagulants, treat the falls. Do not take the patient off the anticoagulants.
That seems really essential because the stroke is the greater risk in a way. But help me understand one thing, because It was my understanding that when we talk about stroke, we're also talking about the potential of a cerebrovascular hemorrhage in the brain. So if you're giving someone a blood thinner, is there increased risk of hemorrhage, therefore? In other words, it's almost like you're walking between a rock and a hard place.
Yes, there is an increased risk of bleeding in the brain, particularly if the patient has some form of vascular malformation. If the patient has bled before, there is definitely a risk of bleeding in the brain. We use what we call stratification schemes or scales to determine the percentages of risk of having a stroke and the percentages of risk of bleeding in the brain. And these are adjuncts. They are useful, but we have to use them with clinical judgment.
So it's a case-by-case basis. You really have to know the patient, their entire history, all of these various factors, and then make the decision.
Yes. Let me insist that these guidelines are not commandments. They are recommendations to reduce therapeutic uncertainty, to help the clinician use their judgment when indicating these medications.
I understand the World Stroke Organization has also endorsed this. So are you looking at this as going to have kind of a larger global impact?
Definitely. The American Academy of Neurology has a global reach, and these guidelines will be read not only within the United States, but outside the United States. So the World Stroke Organization has endorsed them. In fact, the guidelines contain a paragraph that is intended to be used in developing countries where there are medications that are not available in the United States that are less expensive and useful when the new oral anticoagulants, which are quite expensive, by the way, are not available. And this could be the case in 80% of countries around the world.
So what will they do? If the new anticoagulants are not available, what are the choices?
Well, the choice is to use aspirin, which is a low-level choice, or to use another medication by the name of triflusal, which has a structure similar to that of aspirin, but doesn't cause bleeding as aspirin does. And when this triflusal is used jointly with warfarin, similar drug called acenocumarol in developing countries, it could be quite useful in patients with low and moderate risk of stroke who have atrial fibrillation.
So generally, what are your hopes then for these new guidelines? Are you expecting that this will prevent stroke on a worldwide basis?
Yes, I am, and certainly I hope that these guidelines will encourage clinicians to use oral anticoagulants more widely than in the past, to be less fearful of their effects, which definitely can be negative in case of bleeding, but the good side of them, the positive side, is so much brighter. Therefore, we encourage the use of these anticoagulants in old people, very old people, people who have mild dementia, people who have falls, but not too many. And these are neuro recommendations.
Very good. Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Antonio Calabres, professor of neurology at Upstate Medical University and a fellow of the American Academy of Neurology. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.